Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club. It is a podcast-only edition of our Radio Book Club, which is a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, news director at KGNU. As always, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore is my co-host and our guest in studio today. We have Colly Fajardo-Anstein talking about her collection of short stories, Sabrina and Karina. And please do listen to the broadcast version of the Radio Book Club. You'll hear a lot more, but now we're going to delve into a bunch more. I was so interested to see that you had gone to the University of Wyoming. That's in Laramie. Right?
Yeah.
What was that experience like? Because I'd imagine that's... I have been to Laramie. I haven't been to the university. I've been on campus. That must have been quite different from going from Denver.
It was and it wasn't in a lot of ways. So the reason I ended up at the University of Wyoming is I had gone to a university in California and I experienced like extreme culture shock. It was too expensive. There were way too many students in my classes and a number of other things. So I left and I reapplied and I really wanted to stay in the West and I wanted to find a program that was fully funded because as you know, there's no guarantee you're going to ever publish a book or ever make a cent off writing. So when I got to the University of Wyoming, I was filled with such gratitude that they had accepted me and that they were going to pay me to go to school. So despite how windy and cold it was, I was always sort of walking around with this glow, like, I can't believe I get to study here with geniuses like Joy Williams and Brad Watson. And I studied a lot with this writer, Radovid Lapsha-Rowensop. But I loved it for the resources that I got from my mentors who really, you know, put these stories through the ringer. They were not going to let me not write at my ability. So it pushed me to see how great I actually could be as a writer. And there's a lot of nights where you're just sort of like locked in the house because it's negative 25 and all there really is to do out there is to drink whiskey. So I wrote a lot. And after I left, I convinced two of my sisters to get graduate degrees up there.
Did you feel that you needed to have a bit of distance from Denver and Colorado to write about it? Because we've talked to other authors who almost need that, a geographic, like a physical distance between the place you're writing about, because so many of the story, well, all the stories really are, you know, Colorado centric.
Yeah, and Wyoming was helpful because it was only a 3-hour drive. So if I ever got like extreme homesickness, I could just like hop in the car and drive down. But it was really after I had left Wyoming. I lived in South Carolina for a year. And then after that, I lived in Key West for a year. And then I came back and I lived in Durango, Colorado. So it was really while I was moving across the country and in places like the American South that I was starting to notice, hey, Denver has a legacy of unofficial segregation. Like, wait, we have this kind of injustice too, but I had never noticed it because it was sort of like the air I breathed. So I think all of my different stops along the way allowed me to be able to see our state more clearly.
So when you were working on these stories, like you said, they came to you over, you worked on for 8-10 years or whatever it was. At what point do you realize, like, I've got a coherent collection here? Or was there ever a point where you thought maybe you'd work more on one and develop it into a novel? I mean, how does the book get formed from individual stories over 8 or 10 years?
Yeah, so I'm lucky because I guess I was, like, writerly raised by Joy Williams and Radovid, and they're short story writers. You know, they're, you know, Joy is also a novelist, but she's a very strong short story writer. And so she never encouraged me to move any of these into novels. And then I got, you know, really obsessed with Alice Munro. And I saw these great writers who worked primarily in the short form. So for this, I always knew that I wanted it to be a short story collection. But I was working on a novel at the same time because I had such difficulty getting these published individually. And then also I was told from every agent ever, except for my wonderful agent I ended up with, that no one would buy these, you know, as a book. This was not going to be something that was viable and that I needed to have a novel. So I think a lot of the reasons it took almost 10 years to get this book published is just because the market was telling me, you know, short stories don't sell over and over again. So when it did come time to go out for a sale, I had a draft of a novel ready to go, and I had the short story collection. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why this is my first book, and I think that's why sometimes people are shocked, like, this is your first book? And I'm like, yeah, but nobody wanted it for so long, and I kept trying to make it better and better and better.
So you ended up with One World publishing the book, which is run by Chris Jackson. And I was wondering if you could talk about what that experience is. It's a really amazing project that he has that's distributed through Random House, but Chris Jackson's kind of an amazing person, I think, and maybe just talk about what it's like to be with One World and that experience.
Yeah, I feel so lucky and grateful that I'm on One World. We are a groundbreaking, really cool imprint. We have writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates, Morgan Parker, Matt Johnson, Amir Jacob. I mean, the list goes on and on. And it's writers who are really pushing the status quo. And it's really provided a space for us within Penguin Random House where we're given resources and attention. And it's wonderful. And I work with Nicole Counts. I don't know if Nicole would want me to share this, but I was her first acquisition. And Chris gave her that autonomy to go out, find books that you like and you love and develop them. And for her to be able to say, this is the first one I want is a short story collection, and then get it to the National Book Award finalist. Like, it's pretty amazing. So yeah, One World feels like a very warm, supportive, just groundbreaking family.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked about growing up in Denver, working at West Side Books, not seeing yourself represented in any literature. But what did you like to read them when you were growing up? Because I think it is so important that children, young people, like from birth, right, we're reading to babies in utero, but they need to see themselves in books. And for so many people, that's not a reality. You know. So what are your earliest memories of books, and what actually then did capture your imagination?
Yeah, I thought about this recently, because it wasn't that I could not identify with characters, and I think that's why we love books. We can identify with people from across humanity. Like Harry Potter, I really identified with Hermione. Like, I loved her as a character. But I grew up, I became obsessed with Little House on the Prairie. I just like tore through those as a kid. I loved the Chronicles of Narnia, tore through those. I read Congo by Michael Crichton and like James Patterson novels. I mean, I was the reader. But it wasn't until I was in 10th grade and I had a teacher who was an exchange teacher from Hungary, Mr. Andosi, and he gave us The House on Mango Street to read.
Mm, great book.
I loved it. And I thought, oh my gosh, like, these characters are kind of like me. I mean, they don't specifically come from my background, but they're Latina. They live in the United States. And that sort of really unlocked it for me. I thought, okay, if Sandra Cisneros can do this, I can do this too. And then I remember reading Julia Alvarez in The Time of the Butterflies. Mm-hmm. And so I think I had already sort of started this trajectory, but once I found characters I could identify with even more, it just had such warmth and familiarity. It unlocked the world for me.
Now, you said you did a difficult time in high school. I mean, what happened? I mean, you are now a published author, a National Book Award finalist, you know, and I think this is an inspiring story for many people whose traditional primary and secondary education, it's not always a good fit, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't define who you are, right? So just tell us a little bit about your own pathway to being a National Book Award finalist.
Well, it meant getting a lot of Fs and failing all my classes. there's probably a lot of students like me, and I didn't learn the same way everybody else learned. Yeah, I was bored in class all the time. I literally got caught reading inside of my textbooks and like sent into the hall.
But hang on, you're reading, just not maybe reading the book.
I was not reading what I was supposed to be reading. I meant other books. But yeah, I had a really difficult time. None of my teachers ever came from my cultural group. So that was difficult, not to be able to have that kind of relationship where maybe they get you on a different level. And I felt like an outcast through and through. I was never popular. I was always strange. I was always off by myself and self-learning and reading. You know, my best friends were the librarians who would pull. I remember I would come in and they'd have a new Kurt Vonnegut novel like waiting for me. Do you want to read this? But what ultimately ended up happening is that my GPA was so low that if I were to graduate, I could only go to very limited community colleges. And I had already gone through this process where I didn't want to be in high school anymore. So I was encouraged to drop out. And it was a really emotional, difficult thing. It put me into a depression. But after that, I enrolled at Metropolitan State University of Denver. And for the first time, I was able to take classes that I wanted. I was able to take them at the times I wanted. And I was in the textbooks. So I became a Chicano studies minor. And suddenly I was like, oh my gosh, I have all this rich history and it's about me. It was no longer just about this history that I wasn't able to really touch because it didn't impact me or my family.
So, I mean, what message would you like then for folks, and there are so many, who are struggling with the current education system that doesn't really allow people to express themselves in many, for a variety of reasons, but certainly with the increased testing, it seems to have gotten worse, that you do have an incredible future ahead of you, but it might not necessarily be the pathway that is prescribed by society.
Yeah, I think just for people who, like me, who are struggling like that, just like know that you are brilliant. Like you, despite what they're telling you over and over again, like if you are filling your mind up and you're taking in all this information and you're making connections and you're pushing yourself to learn, you are still brilliant despite that. And it might be a little bit harder for you to navigate the system, but you can do it because you're brilliant.
We talked earlier in the radio broadcast about writing about these younger characters, kind of seeing yourself from 10 years in the future. And it seems to me that's such a pivotal age, you know, whether you're in school or having trouble in school or whatever you're doing with your friends. I have a daughter who just turned 11. And it seems like, I think part of your answer was that you kind of this 10-year remove and the characters are getting older. But do you think, you know, given what you said about your schooling and that, do you think that's a period of time that you'll probably revisit, you know, as a writer? Because there is so much happening and so much developing when you're that age.
Yeah, I think so. I would never say anything's off limits. The next book, the protagonist is 17 years old, mm-hmm. But it's the 30s, so she might as well be like 35 years old, you know. but yeah, I think I will go back because I think young girls are so smart and so interesting. And what I felt a lot at that time was a withholding. Like I wasn't able to really show my true self. I kind of diminished myself. I wouldn't ask questions in class. And I think there are a lot of young girls and boys who just don't feel like they have the courage within themselves to show who they truly are yet. And I think that's fascinating because in fiction, I can go into that character's mind and I can see who they truly are and I can show readers how special they are.
One of the writers you mentioned, we were talking about One World Books, your publisher, was Mira Jacob. And Mira Jacob was at the Jaipur Literature Festival here in Boulder just a couple months ago, and I had a chance to talk to her. And you were one of the writers she mentioned. But her newest book was a kind of a graphic memoir. And your story, do you ever see anything that you could do something like that? Because your stories are very visual. I mean, your way of writing is you kind of will sneak in this kind of amazing, you know, visual image, you know, in a sentence or something. Like it's really, I could really see everything. And I, you know, Maeve like always likes to ask about a movie or something, but yeah. I guess, you know, with Mira Jacob being somebody you're familiar with and having her having done that, is that anything that would interest you or have you ever thought in those terms?
Yeah, I love Good Talk, first of all. If you haven't read it, pick it up. It's awesome. Mira taught herself to draw for that book. Yes. It's so cool. Yeah, I think so. I have made like little zines and things that are for my, you know, I turned into classes or whatever that I drew. I grew up drawing. I grew up taking photographs. My Instagram is like constantly filled with photos. I love visual mediums. And I want to see this book made into like the most awesome Netflix special. And I want to see the movie version of Sabrina and Karina. But I do love, there's something about 2D visual mediums that I really love working with. And one of the things I've talked about that's like some crazy dream of mine, I'd love to have a three-dimensional like art installation that's a novel. Sort of like you walk through it and it's a story, but the actual house, the structure of it, that changes the way that you experience it. So putting it out there in the universe, anyone wants to help me.
Do you see yourself staying in Denver? I mean, we talked in the broadcast interview just about how the city has changed so much, how gentrification has changed the city so much and really pushed people out, people with deep, deep roots to the city. And people might be surprised that you as a published author and National Book Award finalist has a hard time like other people in paying rent in Denver. I mean, it really has gotten to the point where we're just pushing people out. I mean, what would you like to be or where would you like to be in the next few years?
I would love to stay here in Denver. My dream is that one day I'll be able to afford property. I want to be able to buy a home, and I want to be able to help our city from inside of our city. But the way things are now, I'm a full-time author, and the way I make a living is I go out and I do speaking engagements, and I teach workshops and things like that, and it also allows me to write. So if I have to take a full-time job in order to pay rent, in order to buy property, I'm not going to be able to produce these books. So I would love it if somehow the universe answers that call and says, here you go, Collie, you're able to live in the city that you love so much.
And this idea of artists, though, being able to live in a city, I mean, we've actually talked a lot about this on KGNU, the commodification of artists, because we have, and this happens in other cities too, but we've really seen it play out in Denver. Artists move into areas that are often kind of more run down. They then bring in a lot of vibrancy. Hey, then the developers move in and commodify that art, and then those artists get pushed out. But there are thoughts and you know, at least discussions happening about how can we foster a culture for artists to be able to live and work successfully in the city. I mean, have you any thoughts on that?
I do, because there are times that I've visited artist residencies and I've talked to these artists in New York City, and they live in a building that you apply for as an artist, and it's sort of somehow there's a tax break or something. It's based on your income as an artist, but it's reserved housing for artists. So I think that'd be really cool if Denver thought about that.
Well, what's next for you now with the National Book Award, of course, looming? I mean, what has that meant for you since the book has been, you know, it's on the cover of the book? I mean, how has that really changed things for you?
It's completely changed my life and my book's life in ways that I am not yet able to articulate. 6 months ago, a friend of mine said this was the little book that could, and now it's a National Book Award finalist. It's incredible, and I think it shows that I have been granted a small slice of institutional power. And as somebody who grew up without very much power and had no power in literature, this is really meaningful, and I hope that I'm able to use that for good and to bring more voices and more stories like mine into the fold.
Well, the stories are incredible. They're collected in Sabrina and Karina by Collie Fajardo-Anstein. Thank you so much.
Thank you.